Well, we have a somewhat controversial subject, but we're going to handle it as delicately as possible and refrain from all unnecessary downgrading of the efforts of Mr. Darwin. It seems, however, that in the last 5 or 10 years especially, a conflict has arisen in society which no one really expected. And at the present time, two hypotheses concerning the origin of man have come into a collision. This collision course is particularly discomforting to the scientific community because it has been generally assumed throughout the fields of higher education that we were safely, solidly, and serenely Darwinian in our explanations of the origin of human life. To suddenly find that it's not true or it is being questioned is a shock which is creating considerable repercussions in various walks of society. Now, the first question we may ask is, why has this particular issue come into focus? I think for one reason, for nearly 100 years, science has been the white hope of the world. We have assumed that science was going to lead us into the golden age, that science was going to bring about world peace, world security, world wealth, that everything was going to go very well, and that there was no need for us to contemplate any spiritual mystery in the background of life. This attitude has changed markedly since the development of nuclear armament. We suddenly begin to question the moral integrities of the scientific hypotheses. We begin to question whether the advancements of science are going to produce the improvements in humanity itself that have been taken for granted down through the years. We are also more or less frustrated in the development of scientific instruments and methodologies. We are now highly involved in the computer and the development of various electronic circuits, etc. All these processes are fascinating to the young, but they do not solve most of the essential problems of humanity. In fact, they ignore them. The computer, instead of contributing, perhaps, to the solution of human employment, is going to create more unemployment. Progress is a way of substituting machines for people, and these machines will ultimately result in a very tragic lack of employment for the human race itself. Also, scientific development of armaments has become a fear factor in human nature. We are more or less convinced that as the result of scientific progress, we are now in a condition and a position in which we could completely obliterate humanity. Now, this does not sound like progress. It sounds more like annihilation. And we begin to wonder why a highly intelligent strata of humanity is willing to go on like this. Why there seems to be no reason in their thinking to slow down destruction or the causes of it. The entire problem is one in which the mind must do what it pleases, whether it results in confusion, chaos, or destruction. Now, a great many millions of human beings who were very much enamored of science have suddenly questioned it. And unfortunately, the scientific community is not rising in a proper manner to defend its own position. Rather, it has a tendency to ignore the wishes, the will, and the fears of the great majority of human beings. They are not responsive to the cries of millions of frightened neighbors and associates. They go serenely on their way on the grounds that that type of progress is inevitable, that it must come, and that any human being who slows it down is a traitor to progress. Now, on the other side of the coin, we have had a little difficulty also with the religious situation. Religion has gradually tried to creep into science. The religious point of view has finally come head-on into conflict with this scientific materialism. Now, there is a good reason, perhaps, for this, but unfortunately, we are also having a little trouble religiously, and the religious difficulties are giving strength and a measure of sufficiency to the scientific difficulties. In other words, if we pick trouble with science, science is in a position to return the compliment. And this is not the way it should be in life. What no one seems to be willing to face at the present time is the simple fact that both the materialistic and the religious attitude towards humanity, both of these attitudes are hypotheses. Science cannot prove its theory any more adequately than religion is able to support its concept of the origin of life. Actually, religion has a little the better of it, but this is not generally recognized. One of the reasons it has the better of it is that the religious point of view is very much older than the scientific. And as we study antiquity and the various systems of knowledge that arose in ancient times and have descended to us today, we find that there has been no major school in the past that has taken the Darwinian attitude. There has been no time in the development of the human ideologies that the concept of man arising from the animal kingdom has received any popular or thoughtful support. It was never part of our great philosophical heritage from the past. Yet we are not in a position to prove that the ancients were unable to arrive at this conclusion if they had wished to do so. The very antiquity that gave us mathematics, astronomy, music, physics, medicine, was certainly in a condition to study the nature of man. And it did. But it never took the turn toward the Darwinian concept. It was never assumed in antiquity that the human being either ascended from or descended from the animal kingdom. Yet the ancient was well aware of animals. He was well aware of the environments in which they existed. He used domesticated animals. He hunted wild animals. And in Alexandria, in Egypt particularly, the zoological gardens made available a very careful study of animal habits and peculiarities. Yet never once among the greater minds of the past has the theory of evolution, as represented by Darwin, taken hold. It was never a method of answering the situation. Antiquity approached the matter in an entirely different way, but it was more or less honest also. Most of the ancients were willing to accept without question that first cause is beyond human comprehension. Now, we may say that this is not true. We may be able to intellectualize a concept of first cause. Antiquity did this. But no matter how it was developed, or how it was supported, or how it was interpreted, it remained an hypothesis. It was an approach to something, the substance and essence of which was beyond human comprehension. Science and philosophy and religion all rose together in antiquity and were only separated in a comparatively recent period of time. It is also obvious that the scientific position is also hypothetical. And both conditions are theories. They are postulates and postulations until we are able to answer the questions relating to first cause and answer them successfully. Before we can tell how life operates, we must answer the question, what is life? What is this energy? What is spirit? What is mind? What is consciousness? What is energy? What is force? We all realize that these processes, these aspects of existence exist. But we are not yet in a position to find a dogmatic definition for any of them. The only way we can define them, even now, is by defining in terms of the consequences of their activities. We do not know what they are, but we are trying to find out, and in some degrees have been successful, in finding out what they do. But their essence is beyond calculation. We are unable, definitely, to discover the essential principles behind existence. We'd like to overlook this and simply deny it. One of the most common scientific attitudes is that when we ask the question why, we should assume that it is the question how. We know how things operate, but we do not know why. We do not know what they are, but we believe we can classify some of the things that they do. As far as the final answer to the mystery of life is concerned, it has eluded us from the beginning. The ancients accepted this truth, namely, that the true and final definition is not available. The complete fact of any of the important questions that we ask, this fact is not available. If we do not know why life exists, what it is, where it came from, why it produces this vast concatenation of forms and creatures, until we get some of these answers, all dogmatism is unreasonable. And yet dogmatism is nearly always based upon ignorance. It is not based upon what we know. It is an effort to defend ourselves against what we do not know. Therefore, today, we have a problem. How did man come into existence? What is the story of life? What is the story of existence? And I think we all acknowledge definitely that the development of the concept of evolution has been useful. Evolution was a more or less obvious answer to a problem that is not obvious. Evolution was a neat way of assuming a sequential progress of life through the various forms of nature in an ascending order from the molecular through the mineral, the plant, the animal, and into the human kingdom. Now, this seemed to be such a neat and trite statement that it was accepted instantly and presented us with the solution to certain secondary procedures in nature, but nothing to do with primary. Even if we prove conclusively that life moves through these kingdoms in an ascending order, we still do not know what that light is, nor do we know why it ascends through these various levels of expression. Some years ago, a discussion was held concerning the possibility of man being a product of the animal kingdom, that somewhere in the remote past, what has been called the missing link, pictured by a very interesting composition by the artist Gabriel Max, that there was a missing link between man and the animal, and that this link was a bridge, and that across this bridge, animals moved to become human. And humanity is more or less an advanced animal creation, and that it has therefore the visible components of an animal existence. But something is different. It has been impossible to prove conclusively to anybody's satisfaction that the inner life of the human being is identical with that of the animal. If we wish to assume another hypothesis, it's true, the unfoldment of form in nature through the various kingdoms as we recognize them, apparently the final purpose of this unfoldment is the creation of bodies, and that these bodies become the vehicles of energies and forces superior to themselves. It is becoming practically untenable in the knowledge that we possess today to assume that the body and the person in the body, that these two constitute one identical being. The body and the person are separate. The person may function through the body and may gradually mold the body into the likeness of its own purposes. But the person and the body are separate beings. Science is reluctant to accept this because to do so would permit the mind to conjure with the thought that if the person is separate from the body, that person can have existence apart from the body. And this is a more or less heretical position in terms of science. It is the opinion of science that the rise and fall of the human being is a complete pattern in itself, that the individual had no existence before his birth and will have none after death. This, however, again, is a hypothetical approach to a problem. No one has yet been able to actually prove that the human being had no existence before birth and is unable to prove with any conclusiveness that it is any existence after death. For scientifically speaking, however, psychology is producing a wedge by means of which it is making it obvious that it is conceivable that the person and the body have separate existences, and that what we would call embodiment is the entry of a pre-existing pattern into a material existence. If this is the case, and there seems to be increasing support of this belief, then it would follow that various levels of life would be embodied in various levels of bodies. This again presents the scientist with a problem because he would then have to concatenate life itself. He would have to assume that bodies are symbols of the degree of life that is within them. This would mean that the life in the mineral would be less evolved than the life in a plant, and that the life of an animal would be less evolved than the life of a human being. Thus, we would have an evolution of a life through a series of forms or bodies suitable to the expression of that form of life. This constitutes a more or less philosophical approach and more or less agrees with the opinions of antiquity.
transmigration, or the entry of human souls into animal bodies, was never generally recognized, and where it was postulated, it was nearly always in the form of punishment. That to be involved in a less-than-human body would be a punishment for the human being. The Pythagoreans, however, and most of the Orientals accepted the symbolical meaning, namely, that the individual who lived below the level of his own humanity would return not in an animal body physically, but on an animal level of human existence, as an untutored, undisciplined, unmoralized creature. The next point that would come into focus then would have to be what the theologian is concerned about, namely, what is it that moves through these bodies? Is there a life that moves through races, nations, creatures, orders of existence, like a thread moving through a string of beads? Is there one life behind all apparent diversities of life? Some theologians, including Aquinas, have been of the opinion that there is only one life, and that finally and ultimately that life is the life of deity. That there is only one source of life and one source of universal energy, and that is this intangible, mysterious being or power or principle which we call God. Now, science has no substitute for this concept. Some scientists have attempted to explain the matter by assuming that life in its own nature is eternal, has no beginning and no end, that there never was a creation of the divine principle of things, which was a kind of great sea of eternal energy in which everything exists, has existed, and will exist throughout eternity. This, however, does not satisfy a number of human concerns, because this one energy has to in some way be conditioned, or various types of living things could not emerge from it. So it has been generally assumed by the more thoughtful of the philosophically minded people that in truth and substance, a divine being consisting of complete unconditioned consciousness, intelligence, and energy has been at the source of existence. What this is in absolute definition, we do not know. But we find it possible, convenient, and almost inevitable to regard it as deity, the one final, ultimate fact of existence. Now, in order to determine the nature of deity, we would have to, in one way or another, become aware of its own existence and the purposes and motions which are innate in it. This brings us into philosophical speculations, which also are a little difficult for modern science to accept. The problem is that to science, the ultimate is a completely impersonal energy. To the theologian, the ultimate is a purposed conscious energy. It is something that is alive and meaningful and purposeful. It is not like the gasoline in a fuel tank, something simply to be used to move a machine. This life is the sovereignty of all things, and we can go back to Pythagoras to try and find out something about ancient knowledge on this subject. To the Pythagoreans, and in their school of thinking, there is, and always has been, only one life in space. This one life in space manifests to an infinity of differentiations, with everything that is conceivable or unconceivable to man is part of the potential of this one life. This one life is all and one. All as the total of everything that exists, In one life, all things live and move and have their being. This one life cannot be analyzed by any of the fragments of itself, but it is the source of all fragmentation. This one life is not only the source of all bodies, but of minds, of souls, of spirits, and of every type of differentiation that exists in space. This one life, then, is the totality of all of the manifestations of itself, plus the nature of its own identity, which is known only to itself. Now, if we would approach this on this type of level of thought, we probably would not require any kind of a major conflict between religion and science, because it would begin with the simple realization that neither has the full knowledge, that neither science nor religion actually has the full understanding of the mystery of existence. There are two polarities involved here. Science searching for reality from the outside, religion searching for reality from the inside. To the religious person, the experience of faith is all important. To the scientist, the experience of fact is all important. But faith, in a strange way, is more available on the universal level than fact. The moment we go into the study of fact, we go against the great wall of matter. We can explore the universe scientifically only on the plane of physical existence. We can send probes further and further into space, but no matter how far we go, there will still be space, and we will not know why it is there or what its purpose is. On the other hand, if we use faith and search more and more deeply into ourselves for the answer, we discover by a mystical experience or an apperception from within our own natures, we discover certain convictions, certain feelings, certain sensory reactions, which all add up to a sense of great believing, of faith, and also the realization that this mysterious thing called ultimate knowledge is not actually necessary to us. Being imperfect creatures in our own ways, being incomplete, the full knowledge of completeness would not be suitable to our needs. What we need always is to search inside in quest of the knowledge of that which we are now and what we must do about it in order to fulfill the destiny that we understand within the span of our own existence. Science is not so emotionally involved in this matter, except on a level of debate. But the scientific point of view is that when we conquer the physical universe, we can achieve our final liberation from ignorance. The difficulty in this point of view is that there seems to be no probability that we are going to conquer the universe. What we call conquering is merely exploring and creating of hypotheses. Whatever we discover leads to another discovery, but the reality eludes us all. So science is content to go on exploring the physical dimensions of the universe, and would like this to be passed on as the proper purpose for education in our public school systems, namely that we are to respect facts above all other considerations. The religionist rather takes the attitude we should respect values above all other considerations. Now, the scientific point of view has greater strength or validity if we wish to take the scientific position that the survival of life after death is an illusion. If the individual, at the end of his present life, ceases forever, and there is nothing to be gained by any idealism or any effort to release values within himself which do not have any existence except in his own mind. If this is true, then the conquest of the material becomes the sole objective of humanity. It can do no more than try to write a full description of the physical existence in which it exists. The scientific point of view, then, would impel us to advance various forms of sciences, some of which are very useful, some of which are not very useful. But the final answer is not just the scientific fact, it is utility. It is the value of it in use. If you remove from scientific progress moral integrities, you get into a very serious condition. Knowledge without integrity is deadly. No matter what skills we possess or develop, if we are not motivated to the proper use of them and not impelled by some power within ourselves to avoid the misuse or abuse of these discoveries, we will gradually undermine existence and destroy the forms of life which we have inherited from the past. So there is something necessary, and this necessary element is a communion between science and idealism. Idealism's principal exponent at the present time is religion. Religion is that factor in our behavior pattern by which we are motivated to the proper use of that which we know. As materialistic education lowers morality, we perceive in daily living the consequences. We are moving into an era of crime and corruption practically unknown in history. We have taken away from the individual the censorship of integrities. We have taken for granted that it is not whether we are good or bad that is important. It is which side has the heaviest artillery. And physical strength and the cunning to create it are the all-important elements of survival. This is simply untrue. These are the dangers which hazard survival. Now, if we could come to a mutual understanding with religion and science, in which the two decide to work together, science probing and bestowing upon religion the dignified right of interpreting all discoveries in terms of human good. If, however, science continues to ridicule religious conviction, or downgrade it, or consider it an interference with progress, then we are going to be in the position in which one day we're going to have a head-on collision between science and religion. And in this headlong collision, I think science will lose. It will lose because the collision will not occur until science itself has abused its privileges and made life practically unendurable for the human being. Also, progress exploited for profit, a partnership between knowledge and wealth. This is again disconcerting and discouraging to the average individual. So there is very much to believe that the rapid increase of interest in religious thinking is largely motivated by the fact that science is inventing a kind of progress with which the human being cannot cope and which will ultimately result in a general destruction. Science has to become moralistic. It has to place censorship upon itself. It has to apply to its own achievements a golden rule of integrities. And in order to answer the question, why integrities? The scientific, industrialized, economic community has another problem on its hands. Is it necessary for the scientist to accept theology in order to correct the processes now in action? Technically, no. It is not necessary for the scientist to become a theologian in order to recognize moral responsibility. All the scientist has to do is give a long, careful look at the consequence of what he's doing. If he can stop for a moment in his progress and realize what he is doing to humanity and not what he is doing for humanity, a great change could result. It is obvious that the present course is a headlong course towards the deification of a planet that is nothing more than a battlefield. So we have this problem constantly, that that a scientist can be a person of integrity. He is very likely already a person of integrity in his personal life. He may be a good family man, a good parent, a sincere son. These things are quite probable. But it is necessary for him to realize that the mind within him must be subject to something stronger than itself. And science is not sure that it believes that there is anything stronger, and is inclined to assume that the moral equation in his own nature is simply an emotional reaction to personal feelings. Actually, now, we are going to have some further delineations of these matters in the public school system. Those who are religiously minded want the theory of creation to be taught to students. The scientific community wants the theory of evolution, particularly the Darwinian form, to be the basis of human instruction. For a large measure, this entire thing is a tempest in a teapot, for the reason that neither side is in a position to scientifically prove its point, and all decision must be in terms of the greater good to the greater number. That which accomplishes the most to advance the ideals, purposes, and constructive concerns of humanity should have precedence. What does the Darwinian theory give us, or give young children who must face a life of international conflict, political corruption, economic uncertainty, and social decline? What does the Darwinian theory do to help those going to school to build lives that are purposeful? The purpose of education is to teach the human being to use the knowledge of his race. If he does not use it, is not impelled to use it, is not inspired to use it, then education fails. And if by a mistaken attitude he accepts, learns, and uses that which is destructive to the common good, he becomes a menace rather than a benefit to the world. Therefore, what has the scientific theory of evolution going to do to the person who is going out to make a living? What is it going to do to him to be a materialist, to decline to accept as superstition anything that is not obvious to his five senses and the scientific community? The answer is it's going to do him very little good. He will never find security in any of the advancements of science. One thing it can do for him, and that is it can help him to protect, preserve, and use the body that he has. But even this is hazarded by many kinds of selfishness on the part of the intellectual group. Theoretically, science can help us, but it can help us principally on the level of body. It can help us to use the structure that we have and to repair it if it is in danger of sickness or dissolution. It can help. But as far as the scientific point of view, giving us personal integrity, giving us happiness in our homes, giving us better-oriented children and a willingness to cooperate for a common good. It does not help us to solve international conflicts. It does not help us to improve political relationships. It does not make our statesmen more honest. It does not make our citizens more frugal or cooperative. All of these things are outside of the scientific domain. They are assumed, as one biologist told me, that the scientist is a teacher of the public, and private morals depend upon individuals themselves. This is a very poor answer to a very immediate question. As the Depression increases, as unemployment rises, as human securities are threatened, what is science doing to meet the emergency? It is going to continue what it has always done, to advance scientific skills and try to convince us that if it can put a man on Pluto, that all is well in the world. This is very attractive to juveniles who have a great respect for Superman and all of these scientific robots that are being fashioned in the entertainment world. But down to the solid facts of life, no science is important or valuable until it is ensouled. Ensouling the science means its dedication to the service of human need. Science does not exist to glorify itself. It does not exist to create profit for corporations. Science exists primarily to improve humanity's relationship with itself on the levels of family, home, health, and other problems. Science must be ensouled, or soullessly it will destroy itself. Now, on the other side of the coin, what are we going to do about the religious group? It is interesting to realize that we often say that the scientist, particularly the scientific community, is the only international, interracial body that we have. It does not make much difference whether you live in a kingdom, a democracy, or a communist state. Biologists get together from all these different points of view and do their research programs. They share knowledge, they research projects, and they pay practically no attention to the political and social relationships of the communities in which they live. They are therefore regarded as a super group, a group welcome in China or Russia or France or Italy, wherever they may be.